Hello, this is The Game Podcast from The Times, and I'm Natalie Sawyer. Joining Gregor Robertson and I today, it is Alison Rudd. Alison, hello, how are you? How was your weekend?
It was good. I went to my first lockdown game, and I was nervous.
Really?
I don't know why. I expected to be sat in the middle of a stand with no desk, no Wi-Fi, no power, and for it to be a nightmare. But Bournemouth, they really looked after the media. We had special little desks, and I think they put in new plugs, and we had big TV screens. So it was all...
Oh,
they made it as nice as they could.
So it was a sort of extended press area for you, by the sound of it, that they managed to accomplish.
We sat opposite the real press box. The real press box was occupied by staff of the clubs, but they'd made sure that the make believe press area was workable, and that's all you want. You want to be able to do your job and not think, "How am I going to file this?" So they were good and apologetic that all they could give us was water, but that was the rule, and it was fine.
Okay. Well, it sounds all very good at Bournemouth. And of course, you were at Craven Cottage, Gregor. Was it similar circumstances for you?
Yes. Very, you know, everyone was spread out very much around the stand, although we didn't have a wee desk. We were sitting on Fulham's old wooden seats, unfortunately. But they did produce power for us. So, it was all very strange. It was, I don't know. Yeah, the game was very entertaining, and I'm sure you were very entertained watching it, particularly at the end.
But, how did you guess?
But it was just, I don't know, there was something sort of huge was missing, and that's obvious what that was. And I think it will affect the players for as long as this continues. I think kind of reaching the very, very peak performance and highest levels that footballers can, I think it's going to be very difficult without fans, sort of, because they help to motivate you and they help you to sort of reach your very best. So, the players put on a really good show in the end, but it was very, very odd. I hope we get used to it quickly.
It's a strange one, isn't it? For both of you, obviously, being at the game, it's very different from the viewer's perspective, because obviously we now have the option of listening to crowd effects, so you sort of feel like it's a bit more of a game if you do have the crowd effects on. How much are you now listening out for what the players are saying, Gregor, for example?
Yeah, I mean, actually... It was more the managers that intrigued me this time. I wrote about that in my column today, because, I mean, I kind of know what players say. I know what they say on the pitch, and it's none of that's particularly surprising to me. But you'd never really hear your manager when there's a crowd inside the stadium, when there's a decent enough crowd anyway. And here, actually, quite often players do their best to kind of not to give any recognition to the screams and shouts from the touchline. But there's no escaping it now. And I was amazed how much Scott Parker and Thomas Frank were kind of hounding and harrying their players and encouraging at times. But, you know, they were very, very vocal. And that was quite interesting for me to watch.
Mm. And was he speaking in Danish, Thomas Frank, at times?
No, it was all well understandable. A lot of telling the back four to squeeze higher. Getting on Pontus Janssen's back quite a lot. Very brave.
Very brave indeed. Yeah, I'm surprised Pontus listened. But Alison, what about you? Just before we move on, did you hear anything different that you haven't heard before, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, it was surreal. I mean, first of all, it wasn't awful. It was quite nice. It felt like you'd been allowed into a private session. And, you know, you've been given a VIP pass, like I'd won it in a competition or something. So I felt quite privileged in that sense. But, yeah, to clearly hear the seagulls and to be able to hear the walkie-talkie of the steward and hear what the walkie-talkie's saying, and then knowing that the walkie-talkie's nearer the players so they can hear it too. I mean, it must have felt kind of strange. I did do a piece where I interviewed some sports psychologists, and they said good players are excellent at blocking out the noise of the crowd if it's there, and if it's not there, blocking out weird noises. So they probably wouldn't have been thinking, oh, I wonder what's going on the walkie-talkie. But from a viewer's point of view, it was being immersed into just a completely different experience, but it wasn't as unpleasant as I expected it to be. As I say, I just ended up feeling quite privileged to... Mm. I mean, I was right on the halfway line, about... 7 or 8 seats up, perfect view. I could hear the players chatting. I could hear the referee talking to the players. It's Christian names, which I think is nice. And no, it was good. It was good. I mean, it wasn't good because it's awful. But I mean, given what it had to be, it wasn't as dreadful as I was expecting.
Indeed. Well, we'll talk more about Bournemouth in a little while, but also coming up, we're going to find out if Gregor is still backing Norwich to stay up after a fascinating weekend at the bottom of the table. And we're looking at some extraordinary strikes from very ordinary players. But first, it's time for this.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Arsenal manager Mikel Arteta says the way his side lost their Premier League game at Brighton on Saturday is unacceptable. The Gunners were the better side for much of the game but threw away a one-goal lead, with poor defending allowing Lewis Dunk to equalise before Neil Mopay scored the winner for Brighton in the fifth minute of added time. Gregor, if we examine Arsenal's performance, was it unacceptable?
Yes, but not unexpected. I think that's the thing you've got to say now. None of this is new from Arsenal. I'm increasingly finding that there's something about this Arsenal team that makes my blood boil, and I don't really know why. It's, you know, I don't support Arsenal, I don't really care how they fare one way or another, but it just feels like this is a group of players who kind of have been very poorly assembled over 5 or 6 years, and they somehow managed to combine being full of bravado and kind of, I don't know, entitlement might be the wrong word, but also having no, I don't know, can I say it? No, having no balls. There's no, none of them can really take responsibility on the football pitch. And I think that is what's so galling and what's why they cop so much flack. You know, people can accept mistakes and even a lack of quality. You can lay that at someone else's door. But when the same mistakes keep happening and happening and no one's taking responsibility out on the football pitch, it's just becomes very hard to watch. And I think Arteta, you know, he's a colossal job on his hands. Huge. There's a phrase in Scottish football where if a player needs to be moved on, like as a matter of urgency, they say he needs to be emptied, and Arsenal need to empty about 50% of their squad. It's like I was looking
that
through
much.
Looking through their squad today, and I would say half of it shouldn't be there, like as soon as possible, as reasonably possible.
So, can you single out some particular names you're referring to then?
Yeah, I mean, we'll be here a while. well, you start, everyone, you know, this is not new me saying this, but you have to start with the defence. Socrates, Mustafi and Luiz, empty them.
Wow.
Holding's had injury troubles, he's 24, he might be worth keeping for now. Callum Chambers is injured, but he's not good enough, so I think he needs to be moved on. Tierney and Bellerin. Bellerin is recovering from injury, he's not pulled up any trees since he's done that, but there are two defenders they want to hold on to. Saka is a shining light for them.
Yeah.
Kolasinac and Maitland-Niles are at best substitutes at a team who are looking to play in the top six. In midfield, Xhaka, Guendouzi, my God, we'll come to him. Ozil, empty them. Ceballos is going to go back to Real Madrid, but he'll be off somewhere else, I'm sure. He's flattered to deceive. Torreira is injured, but I think there's a player in there, and again, he's 24. Joe Willock's a prospect. And then up front, you know, Lacazette and Aubameyang are the two that are being discussed just now. And I think if it comes to a point where you're persuading them and having to push out the boat so much for them to stay and want to stay at Arsenal, then let them go, sell them and use that money to bring people in who are hungry and desperate to play for Arsenal and prove themselves in the Premier League. And, you know, other than that, if you look at elsewhere, you've got people like Martinelli, who, again, he's a young prospect. Eddie Nketiah, you know, guys who are young out of the academy. Reece Nelson, who have, you know, that if that's they're these only players you really are saying you should hold on to, then Arsenal are in a world of pain.
So you've just listed, I'd say, roughly 9 players there that you think should be shown the door at Arsenal. And I say 9 big players, big name players, let's say. I don't know where to begin with it, Alison. 9 players that you're going to have to fill, you're going to have to replace. But we know traditionally Arsenal don't spend big.
No, they're not going to do that. So the onus is now on the manager. But they're not going to, are they? You know they're not going to.
They can't do it immediately, but they need to do it kind of with some semblance of strategy. And they need to start with Guendouzi and Ozil. The central defenders.
Right, you're coming at it from a purely footballing point of view, what they've got on the pitch and who don't cut it as Premier League players. I suspect that's you're not even saying they're not good enough for Arsenal. I take it from the way you were speaking, you just don't think they're Premier League quality. Is that right for a start?
Well, certainly a team that is expected to be among the top 6. Some of them might get into a mid-table Premier League team, but shouldn't be playing for Arsenal.
Right, well, Arteta came in and that was not his brief, and I think this is part of the problem. I'm not saying I disagree with you, Gregor. I just think Arteta came in and we were all told, the narrative here is that Arteta loves the club. He's always dreamed of coming back to be manager one day. He's instilled with the Wenger philosophy. He will come in and rediscover what makes a great club tick. And when he arrived, he said several times he's going to weed out the players who don't give their heart and soul for the club. He's going to not pick players who are moody. He's going to work out who's prepared to fight for the team. And so his brief, if you like, and it's self-imposed to a degree, was an assumption that the talent's there in the dressing room. You just have to make sure it's all on message. And if one or two are troublemakers, they're the ones you drop and hope they learn their lesson. So he did not arrive at Arsenal thinking, I'm going to have to work hard with the youth team and get them to spend some dosh on some decent players and maybe sell a few big names that are overrated. His brief was, we have the core of an excellent team. We just need to make sure the dressing room's back on track and people are talking to each other again. And that, I think, is the problem, because that's only one strand of what's going wrong. And if that's all he's been looking at since he's come in, is an assumption that he has the ingredients, he just needs to make sure, you know, the nuances are right, then I agree with you. It's not going to go anywhere, because ultimately you cannot make people who've had years to improve and iron out the errors in their game. And that Arsenal are a team where history repeats itself constantly. And that is partly because they have faith in players who keep making those same mistakes. So I do agree with you. But I just don't think, I think part of the reason there are so many players on your list, Gregor, is because I don't think Arteta was worrying about their quality. He was worrying about their attitude.
I mean, Arsenal are fascinating, and I'm sure Arsenal fans hate us talking about it for the fact that we find them so fascinating. But right now, Gregor, when you look at Arsenal, they are 10th in the league. They are very much mid-table, and they very much look it.
Yeah, I mean, I think they almost... After these first two games, I think we'll come to the discussion about where we think they should, you know, where they might finish in the table. And I almost think it doesn't matter now this season. It's like, this is the real challenge on Arteta's hands and on the powers that be, the people who control the purse strings. They have to do something to change this, because the thing is, Alison's right. In one sense, it's a cultural problem almost with Arsenal, and I don't think that predates Arteta, and it's kind of deep rooted. And you know, the people who are involved in recruitment and the signings, making the signings, they are part of that problem. So I'm not saying all this thinking that I'm expecting expecting everything to change. I'm not really saying that. I'm just saying this is the reality for them. This is, they have 8, 9, 10 players who are not good enough and don't have the kind of fortitude and the character necessary to play for Arsenal. So that's the position they find themselves in, and how they're going to go about changing it, I don't know. Arteta has got a hell of a job on his hands.
Back onto the game itself then, Alison. Do you think it was a worse performance, that defeat at Brighton, than the 3-0 loss to Manchester City?
I would say they were equally bad, but for completely different reasons. There were lots of excuses for Arsenal's performance against City, including their poor travel arrangements. They just, I don't know, they seemed like they were a bit winging it a bit on how to get there. And you can always have as an excuse when it's the first game back after a long layoff. Some clubs will prepare better than others. Some teams will hit the ground running and some won't. And in some respects, you can forgive the ones who don't. It's not entirely their fault if they didn't quite grasp what it was going to be like. And of course, City are sort of team that nobody's embarrassed to be defeated by. But I just felt they really lacked any self-belief. They didn't look like a team that thought they could win against Man City, which was disappointing. And it was almost the opposite against Brighton. They did look like a team that thought they could and should win, but didn't. But they didn't remember that you have to do that by earning the right to, and you have to see out a game. So lack of discipline, and Gregor, you said entitlement was the wrong word, but I think there was an element of that in this performance, actually. You can play nice football and you can look the better team, but really, really, you don't know every game can go to the 95th minute. That's just crass stupidity.
Well, perhaps that entitlement is what Neil Mopay was referring to in his post-match news conference as well. And Arsenal's afternoon began to turn for the worse when goalkeeper Bernd Leno was taken off on a stretcher with a knee injury after landing awkwardly following a coming together with Brighton's Mopay. A foul was given, but no card was shown, and Leno was unhappy. He made his feelings clear when he pointed at the Brighton striker as he was carried off to lay the blame at his door. So, Gregor, I'm sure you've looked at this incident. You've no doubt reviewed it a few times as well. What did you make of it? And should Mopay have received a card? Was he in the wrong?
No, I don't think so. I think this is pretty innocuous, really. I think it's the kind of challenge and the kind of contact coming together that happens in every single game, really. There is some question to be raised about whether that it should happen, but it's something that's a part of football. But
it was quite talent. It was quite timid, wasn't it? Really?
Yeah, absolutely. There was no, he barely kind of changed the kind of trajectory of Leno when he was coming down. It was just a freak accident. It was horrible to watch.
Yeah.
But Mopay is someone that you'll know this very well yourself, given that he came from Brentford. He has got a little bit of needle, and he does like to kind of, he seems to wind people up without actually having to try. He's that kind of player, and if he was playing in my team, I would like that. If I was playing against him, I wouldn't particularly. So, yes, he did have a bit of an afternoon with Arsenal, and you could say it stemmed from that. But I think it was very innocuous, and I think the Arsenal players' reaction to it was just an emotional one after seeing that their friend and teammate was in a serious had suffered a serious injury, and he was in pain, and they looked to blame someone.
Alison, with your referee's hat on, do you agree with what Gregor said?
Yeah, there's nothing that Mopay did that was against the laws of the game. So you can't book someone just because the outcome is horrific.
Yeah,
that's not what you're supposed to do. So absolutely, I mean, Gregor's absolutely spot on. Well, I mean, you might want to discuss whether there ought to be a rule that if someone's in the air, you don't touch them when they're in the air. But there's no law against it.
Yeah.
So it was freakish. It was freakish, absolutely freakish. And it happened in the 40th minute. You can't let that be what's on your mind throughout the whole game, which was evident at the final whistle. That maybe that was one reason Arsenal lost. They were too busy storing up their indignation for what had happened And instead of thinking the best thing you can do is, well, you know, the old-fashioned thing, which is win the game for your teammate, isn't it?
Well, you mentioned there at the final whistle, tempers did flare. Arsenal players surrounded Mopai, and Matteo Guendouzi put his hand around his neck. Now, what we believe is that VAR did actually look at the incident and they were quite happy with it, felt that there was no need for any punishment to be handed out. So it means that Guendouzi won't face a retrospective ban. Sources claim Arsenal players were taking verbal digs at the Brighton striker throughout the game, born out of frustration following that incident with Leno, which led to Mopai to say that they lacked humility after the game. When you look at what happened with Guendouzi, and now reports suggesting that there won't be any retrospective action taken, what do you think of that, Alison?
Well, I think there's something gone slightly wrong there, because you could argue Martin Atkinson, the referee, might have thought, I'm not sure, let's just let VAR deal with this one. I don't know how good a view he had or what he was being told. But if VAR is going to look at it and that gives an out, and because VAR, as we know, just one person, gives an out and says, no, it's all right, you don't have to give a red card for that, and then that's the end of it because VAR looked at it, that's wrong. The game cannot have players strangling other players out of in vitriol, out of spite, deliberately, because they feel that something's gone wrong. And when a player does that, what Guendouzi is doing by grabbing the throat of Mopai is he's basically saying to the world, referee's got this wrong. The referee has failed to see that there was a deliberate act of aggression that has felled and badly injured a player. And we've got to take our own vigilante action to get it right. You've got to stop all that. You just can't allow that to happen. And also, it wasn't like it happened. This is an hour later. It's unforgivable. And I'm slightly concerned that if Guendouzi was that angry, he allowed it to simmer on that long. It meant he wasn't in the right frame of mind to be doing his job on the pitch either. Yeah. So from an internal point of view, I think they need to have words with him. And I think it's deeply disappointing that image now goes unpunished because VAR had a look at it at the time.
Mm. I mean, it does seem a bit balmy, doesn't it, Gregor? Because I think most people were expecting Guendouzi to get some sort of ban, a three-match ban, perhaps, violent conduct.
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of the idea that because VAR looked at it, no further action can be taken. Is that the idea? Is that what we're hearing, basically?
Yes, exactly.
I mean,
that.
So these sort of rules are insane. If there's an opportunity to right a wrong, it's almost like they don't want to go back and kind of, point out that someone's made an error, or a colleague has made an error. It was like when someone was booked for a challenge and they couldn't be retrospectively given a ban for it. You know, there was all these kind of completely arbitrary, stupid rules. And if he put his hand around his neck and it was violent conduct, it is in modern football. I mean, look, it wasn't crime of the century on the football pitch, but in modern football, that's violent conduct, and there's no reason why he wouldn't be getting a ban. And Guendouzi, I mean,
go on, let's talk about him, because I know you're desperate to.
He's someone who's always, it really has baffled me. I think I said this before. I went back to the game against Spurs last September when they drew 2-2, and he had a good second half. I think he curled in a really good ball for Aubameyang to equalise. And I remember the kind of reaction afterwards. People were saying he should be the captain, like Arsenal's captain going forward for years. I think Ian Wright said that. So many people acting as if he was this beacon this person that the team should be built around. And I was gobsmacked with it. And the idea that he is the shining light, he runs around a lot, he demonstrates spirit, but he can't channel it in the right way. He's a liability. And as long as he's in the team, he will cost the team points through goals or being sent off or just generally kind of reckless behaviour on the football pitch. If he's supposed to be a holding midfielder, he'll charge out and leave gaping holes. So I think he's got to be near the top of the list in the old empty board.
You love that empty board. Arsenal's back-to-back defeats, of course, since the restart mean, as we've mentioned before, that they sit in 10th. They are 11 points off fourth spot, six off fifth place Manchester United. Alison, do you think European football is all but gone for Arsenal?
Yeah, I do. I do. And I sort of feel slightly sad saying that because I suspect Arteta's worked really, really hard and really wants it to happen. And I had some faith in his ability during the hiatus for him to have solved all those problems in the dressing room and created a really good spirit at the club. I thought they would emerge from the break better than when they went into it. And if anything, they look slightly worse. So I don't see where their momentum's going to come from. And also, there's a really bad aura around the place now. You've got Arteta himself saying, this is unacceptable. Given the state they're in, I don't think that those sorts of public utterings will galvanise the team and suddenly make them spurt into action. And I think there's going to be another round of soul-searching and blame-making, and the dressing room will probably divide again and they'll have to start all over again to make it better. So I don't see where the momentum's going to come from, to be quite honest.
And Gregor, what about for you and Arsenal? Where should they be looking at finishing this season? Where do you think they realistically will finish?
I said before, I really think it's, you know, if they finish strong, it would give them a bit of hope for next season. But next season is where it's at now. They're not going to reach Europe. It's going to be mid-table, slightly higher, maybe eighth at best. But I really think that the bigger issue for them is moving some players on, demonstrating that they've learned from past mistakes in the transfer market, or at least starting to, and showing a level of support that Arteta needs. He's shown promise, and I said this last week, he's shown promise. It's nothing more than that. You know, he showed he could organise a team. The team is better organised. It's just that he's dealing with players who are not good enough to play for that football club.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Well, that 3 points for Brighton puts them 15th on 32 points, 5 points above West Ham and 18th place Bournemouth. But does that win put them out of trouble? The bottom four clubs all lost this weekend, but did any of the action make us want to change our predictions on the three teams to go down? Now, rock bottom Norwich lost to Southampton. Villa gave away a lead to lose to Chelsea. West Ham were well beaten at home to Wolves. And Alison, of course, you saw Bournemouth's 2-0 home defeat to Crystal Palace. It was the first game since Eddie Howe confirmed Ryan Fraser won't play for the club again this season after refusing to sign a contract extension. When we just focus on that situation with Ryan Fraser, do you feel that had any effect on Bournemouth at all, Alison?
Well, it couldn't have helped. it really couldn't. But, you know, Fate gives with one hand and takes with the other. David Brooks was back, who's a really talented young midfielder. And he looked rusty because it was his first game of the season, because he had two ankle operations. But he only lasted an hour. But in that hour, he did show glimpses of proper talent, you know, sort of thing that can, you know, open up a defence, do something, create a bit of magic, get you a result that you might not think you could get. But afterwards, he was asked about Ryan Fraser and he said, oh, he's my mate, so I don't really want to talk about it. And the manager's made it clear, if you're not committed to the club, then we don't want you. We don't want you anyway, sort of thing. It would have been an absolute blow to morale, I'm sure. Because if you're in a relegation battle, one of the things you have to do is, you know, stirring speeches, remind everybody, if we're all in this together, we can get out of it. It's our, you know, it's our history, our fans, we've done it before, our never-die spirit, our ability to be better than the sum of our parts. And then if you get a key player saying, well, actually, I don't want to be part of that rousing, stirring finale that saves the day, it will puncture that enthusiasm. So I'm sure it did have an effect. I wouldn't call it the excuse or the reason for the defeat, but I dare say, I don't see how it could not have been a negative contributing factor.
Yeah. Well, the stats don't look good for Bournemouth. They failed to keep a clean sheet in each of their past 13 league matches, and they've lost 7 Premier League games in 2020. No other side has lost more during this calendar year. From what you've seen of Eddie Howe and perhaps at that game, Alison in particular, does he look broken? Does he look like he's still got the fight?
It's not Eddie Howe's style to give those sorts of public no. rousing speeches. He is steady Eddie, isn't he? He sounds pretty much the same whether he wins or loses. And in fact, I think he's gone on record to say he's very pleased he is like that. So whenever he's had a superb win against the odds, he will sound exactly the same as if he'd lost. And he will say, I don't want to get carried away. So it's probably asking too much for him to become a different type of personality because they're in deep trouble. Hmm. But the problem is, because he is steady Eddie, it gives the impression that he's run out of ideas because he's not saying anything new. He's just being very calm and polite and decent about it. He doesn't offer excuses. He doesn't complain about anything. But maybe at this, I mean, they're not going to. They owe him so much, and he's been a fantastic servant to the club. And I can see them even thinking, well, we'll stick with him if we go down, and I'm sure he'll do a good job getting us back up. I think we're at that stage with Bournemouth now. But, and I wouldn't really say now there's any point in changing the manager. Although it would be really fascinating, wouldn't it, if someone did sack their manager during lockdown? That would be remarkable.
Ooh,
but
yes.
I don't think they're going to. But I do think it's hard to imagine what he's doing differently behind the scenes to change it. I'm not sure he's got the resources to do much anyway, so it has to come from, you know, some sort of weird team bonding session or mixing it up a bit. They just don't seem to have quite the resources or that, I don't know, that sort of aggressive, no one likes us, we don't care. Everyone quite likes them and cares a tiny bit. It's just that's not enough to get out of trouble.
So, Gregor, what do you think of the Eddie Howe situation? Do you think, well, if they were to go down, that Bournemouth would stick with them, or do you think it's coming to an end?
I think it could go both ways. I think, you know, this is a long-standing thing. It's not, you know, I think they've won 12 of the last 50 Premier League games, and I think there are, you know, they've had some injuries to key players. Callum Wilson has just not had the season that he has had in the past. I think his leading goal scorer 8 goals. And I also think there is something that is kind of about transitioning from the core of players that got them to the Premier League and helped keep them there and kept it kind of, I don't know, kept the identity of that football club to the fore. You know, I think Steve Cook is probably the last man standing of that group. Mm-hmm. Harry Arter's moved on to Fulham. Charlie Daniels, knee injury, and he's getting on. Chyman Francis, same, had a long-term knee injury. He's come back, but he's 35. I think, you know, we're seeing the end of an era here what's been a remarkable story. And, you know, when that happens, there's always... it's usually the manager who goes. Otherwise, you've got to look at changing a lot of players. Or, you know, they make the change with the hope of someone else being able to inspire or reinvigorate that group of players better. I mean, look at Spurs and Pochettino. It's kind of almost the same sort of thing. An era kind of becomes stale. A tenure becomes stale, sorry. And they look to make a change. But look at Spurs now. I mean, with Spurs, Spurs aren't looking any better. So, and they had a manager there who loved the club deeply. And Bournemouth have the same. They have a manager who's deeply attached to that football club. And if you just ask the simple question, who is going to be better placed, if it comes to it, to rebuild or to help take that club back up? And I can't think of anyone.
Has Eddie Howe's stock fallen since a few seasons ago, Alison, when he was tipped for great success?
Oh, God, it has. But I don't think that's his fault. I think he was overhyped, to be quite honest, because he was young and English and reasonably good-looking. People just went over the top. I have no idea why.
Because he's reasonably good-looking, obviously. But, I mean, when you think back to a few seasons ago, Gregor, he was tipped to move on from Bournemouth. He was tipped to perhaps even Everton were a club linked with him, for example.
But it's Arsenal.
Arsenal, indeed, as well. But it's
England.
All... See, was, you're listing them all.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly was. I think that partly that represents... that's a cause of kind of there being very few people like Eddie Howe. As I mentioned in one of our lockdown pods, England aren't doing managers very well at the moment. And he was someone who was kind of a bright young hope. And maybe, you know, I still think he is someone who is he's a fine coach. And I've seen him match. I've seen him take training sessions before. And I was amazed by the kind of detail and intensity of it. And I know one or two Bournemouth players who've been on that journey and you know, they've got nothing but positive words to say about him. So I'm sure he's going to have a top career, whatever happens, a long-term kind of career at the top level, whatever happens with him at Bournemouth this season and beyond. But yeah, I think Alison's probably right. I think maybe people did get carried away a bit, but that's because who's the next Eddie Howe?
And because he's sort of good looking. But as it stands then, the bottom three is Norwich, Aston Villa and Bournemouth. We'll come to you, Gregor, then first, because obviously we've had a few opportunities to talk about how we think the bottom three is going to end up. And you've always said, no, you think Norwich are going to come good. This is going to benefit them playing behind closed doors. And then what goes and happens in their first game at Carrow Road, they lose 3-0 to Southampton. Are you still sticking by it? That Norwich will
teething
survive?
Teething issues, yeah. I think Alison was quite strong in the Norwich camp as well.
No, I think you were right.
Anyway, look, I think the, you know, I said Tim Close are coming back, their best defender was big, and then Grant Hanley, Christoph Zimmerman and Sam Byram were all ruled out for the rest of the season. So they've had some tough luck there. But the truth of the matter is, in both boxes, they haven't been good enough. They conceded 57 goals when they won the championship last season, and they didn't improve on that defensive back line, and it's shown. And Pookie started like a house on fire. They were far too reliant on him, and when the goals dried up, I think they've not scored in six of their last nine games. So it's looking very difficult for them. I don't know.
We'll changing your mind, Gregor?
Ask me after the next game.
Okay, all right. But as it stands, as I say, Norwich, Villa and Bournemouth, any of those other teams that you're thinking will go down?
I don't think we learned anything new, particularly about West Ham or Watford. I think West Ham looked solid and organised, and then Adama Traore came on and he turned on the afterburners and set up two goals, and that changed the game. That's why they lost. And Watford, you know, I think they looked organised. Ben Chilwell scored a screamer, and they showed the kind of spirit and endeavour to keep going right to the final whistle, and they stole a point. So I don't think we've really learned anything new about them. I still wouldn't say Brighton are completely out of it because they beat an average Arsenal team, and they've got very difficult running. So, you know, I think the three in the bottom three just now are looking like the most likely to go down, but I wouldn't rule out, I wouldn't say that we've learned anything particularly new about the other three.
Okay. And Alison, what about you and your bottom three? Has anything changed from this weekend for you?
I'm slightly less enthusiastic about Norwich because I felt if they had hit the ground running, I think a lot of people would have bought into their ability to climb out of it because they don't score enough goals, but they rarely play badly. Mm. And I, you know, which was the worst performance, Norwich's or against Southampton or Arsenal's against Brighton? You'd still say, well, Arsenal's was worse. So I don't. You know, there's always something to point to at Norwich and think, you know, if it clicks, if they get a bit of luck, they'll be all right. I'm not giving up on them yet, no. Because
I think we're the only podcast who aren't.
I know. But there is something quite seductive about how sunny they've remained throughout a difficult period, I think. And they are entertaining. I mean, who do you want to stay up? Someone who entertains or someone who doesn't?
Oh, you see, you two need to be doing the OTBC on the ball city. That's what you need to keep saying. And who knows, maybe they'll come good for you both. And you mentioned Watford there, of course. They grabbed at a vital point in the scrap for survival in what was a frenetic finale on Saturday at home to Leicester. It was goalless after 88 minutes, but then enter Ben Chilwell, who out of nowhere gave the visitors the lead with a stunning long-range strike. Coming in from the left, the England left-back arrowed the ball past an outstretched Ben Foster and in off the far post, but Watford refused to give up and were again level just moments later in similarly unlikely circumstances. There was a bit of a scramble in the box and the Watford centre-back, Craig Dawson, leapt up and scored his first Hornets goal with a brilliant bicycle kick, sealing the 1-1 draw in the fourth minute of stoppage time. Two cracking goals actually in this one when you consider Ben Chilwell's as well. But Gregor, how do we go about describing Craig Dawson's?
Unlikely. I mean, yeah, he's actually always had a decent goal scoring record. I played against him when he started out at Rochdale, and I remember always thinking back then, you know, he scored a lot of goals. I think he maybe scored one or two against the teams I was playing for, unfortunately. And I looked today and he scored 21 goals in 93 games from centre half for Rochdale starting out then. And he's always popped up with goals. Never a bicycle kick, I have to say. But he's someone who's kind of dangerous in the box. So it was a fun. He's one of these where he said, I think he said afterwards, it's like you try it in training and you comes off your shin and goes over the crossbar, but it went in and a hugely important goal for them.
Did you ever try one in your career, Gregor?
I think we all know the answer to that, so let's move on.
Come on! What about in training, at least?
In training, yeah. And as I say, they hit the shin and go over the crossbar mainly.
And what about Alison? Surely you must have attempted one, Alison.
No. I know my limitations. There's nothing more embarrassing than... Oh, no, I wouldn't have tried one. I mean, just actually going for a header, I thought was pretty brave of me most.
Oh, absolutely.
I love the way, if you watch the goal, Craig Dawson, he keeps his eye on it. And there's something about when a player executes a lovely goal like that, if you watch it, they look like they always knew they were going to score it. And there's a sort of force field around them. So although from one angle, it looks like quite a crowded penalty area, from another point of view, it looks like he creates this sort of space and that it's all falling into place for him. And everything about it was sort of technically spot on. And it would have been completely instinctive, but it's not like a clumsy centre-half's goal. It's a properly, beautifully executed, snatched goal. But it's really good.
So was this the best goal of the weekend, Gregor?
I mean, the worst competition, Chilwell's, was an absolute screamer. I mean,
wasn't it? What a left foot.
Yeah, I mean, the view from behind, you know, it was perfect for the camera angle. He just hit it absolutely beautifully and sweetly, sort of in his top corner. So that was a cracker. And then Pedro Neto's volley for Wolves. Mm. You couldn't have caught that much sweeter too. So, yeah, some great goals. It was a strange week, kind of first week of football, I think, overall. And I think only, was it five of 22 goals in the first half? It seems to be all quite cautious and then teams kind of find their stride a little bit as the game progresses. And that's to be to be expected, I suppose, but some great goals nonetheless.
I guess no one expected a centre-half like Craig Dawson to do what he did on Saturday at Vicarage Road. It was an extraordinary goal from, and forgive me for referring to you as this, Craig, an ordinary player, shall we say. Can we think of any other examples of this? Some Premier League classic strikes from unlikely sources. I know we've had Stephen Reid. He's had a 30-yard stunner, for example, for Blackburn against Wigan. Manuel Figueroa inside his own half for Wigan against Stoke. I mean, there's been plenty of unexpected goals. So what about your most extraordinary goal that's come from an ordinary player? Alison?
Well, I don't think he's ordinary, but a lot of people have laughed at me for saying that I think he's an extraordinary player. So if I accept that other people's opinion and go for Charlie Adam as an ordinary player, his goal from deep in his own half at Stamford Bridge, I mean, it wasn't just, you know, the halfway line, it was plus 20. And I was there, you see, so it felt almost spiritual, because I'd been nudging people and saying, he's going to do something special today. I can tell. I'm a big Charlie Adam fan, you know. I can tell when he's in the mood. And they were all looking at me like I was completely nutter stalker. And then he goes and produces one of the most beautiful goals the Premier League has ever seen. At, you know, and it's not like it's a goal against a rubbish team. This was, you know, top Chelsea side. And it was just incredible. And I suppose people call him ordinary because he's not got the physique of a top athlete. And maybe he does sort of blunderbuss around. But I think because I was there and I expected it to happen, it was the most wondrously unexpected goal. It wasn't unexpected to me, but it was for everyone else.
I love that. The Charlie Adam fan club, which is obviously started by you, Alison. I like that. What about you, Gregor? Have you got one for us?
Again, I'm not entirely sure if he was ordinary, but it was a hell of an unexpected one. If you go back to 1996 and Philip Albert's chip against Manchester United, the 5-0 win for Newcastle, I think it was the fifth goal. He kind of collected the ball, stepped into midfield and kind of continued, just ran with it, and no one really closed him down. And the goalkeeper was off his line and he just dinked the goalkeeper, and it was a kind of euphoric moment. 5-0 win for Newcastle. Newcastle in their pomp then. So I think that's probably my... Do you know, although he's obviously not ordinary, but it's the unexpectedness is the thing of this. I think you've got to throw Vincent Kompany's goal last year into this. Clearly
against Leicester?
Yes.
Yeah,
because you know he never scored a goal that came close to that, and he was dangerous in the box and stuff. But and for the kind of the importance of that moment, and it was an absolute wonder strike. So I think he could throw that in. I know he's not ordinary, but again, one of the most unexpected strikes you've ever seen.
Yeah, and also when you think back to, I think Pep Guardiola afterwards sort of saying, "What are you doing, Vinny? What are you doing?" Yeah, and then he goes and scores. So even his own manager wasn't expecting it. And perhaps the description of ordinary player is a little harsh, because obviously all these players are playing in the Premier League, one of the best leagues in the world, so they're not doing too bad. If I was to just, from my own opinion, and I'm actually going to Brentford here.
That's a surprise.
I know. There was a player, a Welshman called Paul Evans, who I believe now is the physio, or no, a masseur at Leeds.
I played with him at Forest, actually. Yeah.
Yes, you would have done. Yes. So he scored two goals from the halfway line within a week and a half for Brentford. And I was at the one at Griffin Park, and I forget who we were playing, which is terrible. But I was sat with my dad, and I both remember when it was a bizarre moment. We both were thinking, and we both said it out loud, what is he doing? Oh my goodness. And you just went mental, because it was a great goal, but thinking, what are you playing at? But anyway, it led to a great goal for us. And as I say, he scored two in about a week and a half. So that was pretty impressive. So that is it for now. Many thanks to Gregor and to Alison as well. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Just search The Times subscription for more information. And we will be back with you on Thursday.
now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.